Today, in part 4 of our series, Women of the Old Testament, the subject is Hagar, as described in Genesis 16. Is getting your own way always best? God has a habit of meeting people at their lowest point. Have you ever hit bottom only to have God come to you, unasked, and repeatedly? Thankfully? Here's Pastor Seth.
The title of today's message is Hagar, the Woman Who Wasn't There. The last part of the title of today's message is a title stolen from a documentary that was filmed in 2012 about a true story. Following the World Trade Center disaster, there was a particular woman named Tanya Head who told a very gripping story about her own story of survival on 9/11 in New York. It was such a gripping, intense story that a number of the survivors rallied around her, and the World Trade Center Survivors Network was born. She became the president of this, and for several years, it became a very strong, vibrant source of encouragement for many of the survivors who also had tales of surviving. One of the guys that was doing the documentary, as he dove into the story and did some more research, discovered the irony in this story was that Tanya Head, her testimony of surviving that day, was a complete fabrication. She wasn't there at all. And yet her story gripped so many of the survivors, and when that began to unravel, of course, it shook a whole bunch of people. Now, we're going to look at the life of Hagar today, and Hagar was certainly there in the life of Abraham and Sarah. But I want to use the title, The Woman Who Wasn't There, in a very different way, not in a physical sense, but in a personal, relational, emotional sense. This story, if you were here last week, is going to parallel the one we looked at last week, where we looked at Abraham and mainly Sarah. Now we're going to look at Hagar's side of the story as it unfolds. So if you were here last week, you're going to go, boy, this sounds familiar. It is, except through the eyes of Hagar. You'll recall that God had spoken to Abraham in Genesis 12, what we call the Abrahamic covenant. Through your descendants is going to be a mighty nation. Down through the ages, the sands of the sea and the stars of the sky. For about 10 years, there were no descendants, not even one. We come to Genesis 16, and Abraham and Sarah are no spring chickens anymore, and you know what? And God comes to him in 15, says, you're going to have children, again, an offspring. And he says, but when? When? And in chapter 16, Sarah panics, and so does Abraham. And we pick up the story in chapter 16, 1. Now, Sarah, Abraham's wife, had borne him no children, but she had an Egyptian maidservant named Hagar. We don't know much about Hagar. She was an Egyptian, what we hear here. And you wonder, what is a woman who's an Egyptian doing in the promised land? There's some kind of, we're not told why or what the story is, but usually those things don't happen unless there's some type of pain or crisis. We don't know if, we're allowed to speculate here, but did something happen in her childhood with her immediate family or something beyond her? Or as a young adult, was there some crisis that was precipitated to where it made sense to her to leave her nation, her land, her people, and her language to go somewhere else? Then we learn that she's a handmaiden. She's a servant, a personal servant of Sarah. A menial job was certainly, as we would say in our time, no job prospects and no possibility of job advancement. There's no mention of a husband, no mention of children. We're not told how old she is. She ostensibly is younger than Sarah. But you sort of have a picture between reading between these three things of a woman who is invisible, who even though she's alive, she lives in a world where, and a lot of women in their quiet moments ask this question, does anybody see me? Do I really matter to anyone? Does somebody want to know me? Want to know what I think, what I feel? It seems to me that a woman's greatest fear down deep is this fear of being invisible, being around people where nobody really wants me or nobody really sees me. When I think of Hagar, I think of that as sort of the epitome of this. Even though there are people around her, I would think that she would feel quite invisible. Verse 2, so she, meaning Sarah, said to Abraham, "The Lord has kept me from having children. I've got an idea." We looked at this last week. She says to Abraham, her husband, "Go sleep with my maidservant Hagar. Perhaps I can build a family through her." Abraham agreed to what Sarah said. Now, last week we looked at that this was sort of kind of similar to what we call having a surrogate mom. We can't have children, but maybe there's another mom out there that could deliver. But it's different from how we think about surrogate, because in the surrogate process, both of the couple are sort of physically removed from the whole insemination process. In this case, they're not. And in this case, it's also a little bit different because it's not that there's this surrogate mom out there somewhere, but this is sort of like in our culture today where if these two, Abraham and Sarah, were talking, she would say, "I've got an idea. What if our nanny becomes the child? The live-in nanny becomes the child's mother here." Now think about that in our culture today. Think about the kind of drama that would unfold as this is going on. But apparently the pain was so great for Abraham and Sarah, their faith so small, that this seemed like a good idea, even though it involved adultery. Verse 3. So after Abraham had been living in Canaan 10 years, Sarah, his wife, took her Egyptian maidservant Hagar and gave her to her husband, notice, not to be the surrogate mother, but to be his wife. In addition to adultery, polygamy is added here. Also is a good idea. And so reading between the lines, I think, what happened between the idea of the surrogate mother and giving where Sarah gave Hagar as a wife to Abraham? And I think, again, something along the lines of this. When the idea was presented to Hagar, she said, "I don't like this. Am I just a body? Am I just a thing to carry a baby? I long for something more. I don't have a husband. I would like to have a husband. I would like to be a mother, but I'd like to be a mother of my child and not just the delivery of a child and then off the child goes." And so we would call some kind of negotiations were going on, and eventually Sarah said, "Okay, deal." And so the end of verse 3 says that she gave her to her husband to be his wife. Verse 4, he slept with Hagar and she conceived. Now at this particular point in time, think about what's going on in Hagar. Egypt didn't go so well, had to flee the nation. Don't know why. Kinsmen, country, language, culture, all behind her. She starts a whole new world in the promised land, a whole new life. And as the years go on, there's no husband, no child, no job prospects. She's the invisible woman. And suddenly her longings come alive. She had thought she would never marry, probably. There's no Egyptian men running around in the promised land. Probably never be a mom. And suddenly that dream has been resurrected. She is going to have a husband. And the man that she is going to be married to, in her mind, is probably one of the finest men she's ever known. Though, as you know, Abraham, he's really no peach. But she didn't know that yet. And not only is she going to be married to one of the finest men she knows, she's going to have a child, and that child is going to have probably one of the finest fathers that she can think of. Her life is opening up again. But he slept with Hagar, she conceived. When she, Hagar, knew she was pregnant, she began to despise her mistress. Now, what's going on here? Now, again, we're sort of left to read between the lines, but this is what I think happened, is that the two slept together, and by the time they slept together, and by the time she knew she was pregnant, let's say roughly about 6 weeks, Hagar's dreams and her longings that she imagined were going to happen are now shattering right in front of her. And it starts with something along, I think, something along this line. She imagined that she would be at least equal with Sarah, have the same status as Sarah. She was the younger of the two. And she was the one pregnant with child, Sarah not pregnant with child. What do you imagine she would have thought her future would be? Something along the line of the favored one, the higher status, the one that's going to be, finally will have my man. And what she ran into was that Abraham, during the day or at night, went home and slept with Sarah. Hagar went back to her tent alone. And in spite of being the favored one, the pregnant one, the younger one, she was still alone, except now she was pregnant with child. In our own culture, we call these teen moms. Dating their high school sweetheart, and they can't get the guy to commit. And so they imagine that if I can just go to bed with him and have his child, that will cement the deal, and we'll get married and raise our family. And of course, as you know, in our culture, that hardly ever works. Usually the single mom, the young teen mom, ends up being a single mom, having to either raise the child herself or to raise a child for adoption. And inside of Hagar, the writer says she began to despise her mistress. Her dreams had shattered. Verse 5. And Sarah said to Abraham, as we looked at last week, "You are responsible for the wrong I am suffering. I put my servant in your arms, and now that she knows she's pregnant, she despises me. May the Lord judge between me and you." She puts all the blame on Abraham. And then verse 6, "Your servant is in your hands," Abraham said. As we looked last week, he wimps out and does not take any responsibility for the problem or the solution. He says, "Do with her whatever you think best." And then Sarah mistreated Hagar, so she fled from her. Now at this point, I imagine Hagar is utterly crushed. And she could expect maybe this to happen between Sarah, the kind of drama that plays out here. But I think she was stunned when Abraham would not stand up and say a word for her. As our high school kids say in our culture at this point, "My life is over." And perhaps that's what she said. As Sarah mistreated her, the scriptures reply, she fled. She took off. Verse 7, "The angel of the Lord found Hagar near a spring in the desert. It was a spring that is beside the road to Shur." Now, where'd she go? Well, the scripture tells us that she went to the desert. Now, there are a lot of desert around the promised land. Which direction did she go? Well, the scripture says that it was the spring that is beside the road to Shur, which is in the northern part of the Sinai desert on the way to Egypt. She's on her way back to her ancestral home, and she's beside a spring of water. Now, up until this point, there is not any reference noted of Hagar calling out to God, praying to God, seeking God, throwing her heart at the mercy of God, asking for anything from God. She's a world where God is just sort of an idea or somebody out there, but as she's living her life based on her longings, her dreams, and the shattering of those dreams, and her longings and dreams and the shattering of those dreams, as if God really doesn't exist or does not matter all that much. But notice what happens in verse 7. "The angel of the Lord found Hagar." You would expect to read something along the lines here, that finally in her misery, she reaches out to God, calls out to him, and God responds. But the image is almost the exact opposite of that. The image is of God on the move, following her right out into the middle of the desert on the way across the Sinai Peninsula back to Egypt. The angel of the Lord found Hagar. It wasn't that he had lost her. The idea is that he was following her, continuing to speak to her as he had all of her life. And finally, at a moment, she recognizes this. On the road to Shur. Verse 8. "The angel of the Lord said to Hagar, Hagar, servant of Sarah, where have you come from and where are you going? She says, I'm running away from my mistress, Sarah, she answered." Now, how does God speak to her? First thing he does, he calls her by name. Now, this is the woman who, in my estimation, was the woman who was invisible, who has lost everything and all of her relationships and is going back to probably a very dysfunctional place back in Egypt, but somebody knows her name. And the first word out of his mouth is her name, Hagar. And the second thing that he says is to her is servant of Sarah. Now, why does he say that? Now, she had resigned her position, so to speak. But what God says to her is something along this line. You had an identity back there. You were a somebody. And what you were doing, though it may have seemed menial to you, was important to me. And then he asked her two questions, rhetorical questions. Where have you come from? Where are you going? Two good questions. It wasn't that God needed information. They were just the kinds of questions that when life sort of falls apart, your dreams shatter, you're in some type of misery, these are good questions to ask. Where have I been? Now, she answers in a geographical sense. I've been back with Sarah that mistreated me. That's true. But if she were to answer this question more realistically, more personally, relationally, she would have said, where have I been? I've been in two places. I've been in Egypt, and I had hopes and dreams as a little girl there, and my hopes and dreams were shattered there. And I fled, and I came to the promised land, and I had hopes and dreams there, and my dreams shattered there. I thought I would be married and be a mama and raise my kids, have a family, grow old, and all of that's gone too. Nowhere does she mention that she's been with God or had a relationship with him. And then the second question is, where are you going? This particular question, she doesn't answer. It's sort of a question left hanging, almost like a rhetorical question. Something along this line. Well, I guess I would say I'm going back to Egypt, but come to think of it, that doesn't sound like a very good solution to my problem either. Something along the lines of that. Then the angel of the Lord told her, go back to your mistress and submit to her. Go back to your mistress and submit to her. Now, that would be hard to hear on one level, but at another level, what God is saying is you have a place there and you have some security there. What she doesn't quite know yet, but she will, is that you're going to have a son and that boy is going to need his daddy. And even though this is going to be a painful situation with drama going on between you and Sarah, this is the place. It's not a pain-free existence. There's no such place in our world. But I will meet you in your pain, and I will help you through this, is the idea here, and submit to her. Then the angel added, I will so increase your descendants that they will be too numerous to count. If your life was over in your mind and you heard that prophetic word, there are three things that would strike me. The first is, my life is not over. From God's point of view, there is a future for me. And the thing that would strike me the most, and I think the thing that struck her the most, was that she was not forgotten. Even out in the middle of the desert, middle of the wilderness, on the road to Shur, God had not forgotten her. The angel of the Lord also said to her, you are now with child and you will have a son. You shall name him Ishmael, for the Lord has heard your misery. Now there's something going on here in her relationship with God. Most of what God is saying to her doesn't have to do with her problem. Her logistics problem about food and water and where are you going to live. Most of what he's doing here is wooing her. The Lord who hears me. The Lord who sees me. The Lord who has not forgotten me. The Lord who has a future for me. And then the name of the child, Ishmael, he says, you're going to name him Ishmael, which is Hebrew for the Lord has heard. The Lord has heard. She adds the part about misery, or she thinks about misery, that God has seen her in her misery. Now think about this. Maybe 8 months, 7.5 months later, she's going to give birth to a boy. She's going to call him Ishmael. He's going to grow up. Imagine him 2 years old. Ishmael, get up. It's time for breakfast. And when she calls out his name, what she's going to be saying is, "The Lord has heard me in my misery." And it's lunchtime. Ishmael, come in. It's time for lunch. The Lord has heard me. It's time to come back in for dinner. Ishmael, Ishmael. The Lord has heard me in my misery. Ishmael, it's time for bed. The Lord has heard me in my misery. Now, the next thing that God says to her, no woman who's pregnant wants to hear about their child. He will be a wild donkey of a man. Not exactly what you hope will happen when you imagine you're going to give birth to a son. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand against him. He will live in hostility toward all his brothers. Now, as a young mom, you think about, we have a couple little boys that have been born, and you can imagine in our own church, you can imagine what you imagine. You think about holding your son and teaching him how to walk and how to talk and say, "Dada and Mama." Imagine you're going to teach your son how to play t-ball. Going to go out and throw the ball around. Mom's going to take him to kindergarten. Got his little bag, little thing of sack lunch with him. Got his little notebook, his backpack. Think about him in high school, becoming a young man. Finishes high school and off to college and becoming a young man. And you know, all those dreams are out in front of you. And you hear the angel of the Lord said, "This kid is going to be a moron. He's going to be a nightmare. This is one conflict after another conflict. All of his growing up years and all of his adult years and for generations to come." Now, what's surprising to me here, and it shouldn't be, is Hagar's response. Instead of getting down about this, there's a sense of wonder here. And notice her response in verse 13. She gave this name to the Lord who spoke to her, "You are the God who sees me." Now think about what's happened here. God meets her in such a way that's extremely personal. He sees me. He hears me. I have a future. My life is not over. Even though it's going to be painful back there with Sarah and a lot of drama, and even though it sounds like my son is going to be a really tough kid to raise, there's something bigger that she has caught. And that is that God is going to walk with her in all of her pain and all the difficulties. And so not only does God name her son Ishmael, but she gives a name to God. And it's "You are the God who sees me, even in my misery." In the book of Hosea, one of the verses I love in this book is the people go into a time of judgment. God takes them to the metaphorical desert, strips them of all of the blessings of which he had given them, to where finally they are face to face with their own sin and their self-centeredness. And in chapter 5, we see, "Then I will go back to my place until they admit their guilt. They will seek my face in their misery. They will earnestly seek me." Does it really take that sometimes? To finally put God first in our life? To put him at the center? To worship him, really? To let him be ahead of me? Apparently so. It was true with Hagar. Verse 14, "That is why the well was called Be'er Lahoi Roy. It is still there between Kadesh and Bered." And those are three Hebrew words that mean "the well of the living one who saw me." The well of the living one who saw me. So Hagar bore Abraham a son. Abraham gave the name Ishmael to the son that she had born. He comes back. She comes back. His birth. She says, "Abraham, I already have a name picked out." He says, "I'll go with it." Abraham was 86 years old when Hagar bore him. Now, the last part of the story fast forwards about 15 years. She's back there with Abraham and Sarah. Ishmael is has become 13 years old when Isaac is born, and then maybe a couple years roughly before he's weaned, we pick up the story in chapter 21. A child, meaning Isaac, grew and was weaned. And on the day Isaac was weaned, Abraham held a great feast. So Sarah saw that the son whom Hagar, the Egyptian, had born to Abraham was mocking. And she said to Abraham, "Get rid of that slave woman and her son, for that slave son woman will never share in the inheritance of my son Isaac." Now, we're not told that Sarah had was privy to the prophetic word about Ishmael being a wild donkey of a man, and he's going to be against all of his brothers, and his brothers are going to be against him, and he's not going to get along with anybody. We have no idea if she knew that. But you can be pretty sure by the time he was 15 years old, that was pretty apparent to this mama. And she looked at that 15-year-old son and kind of the nutcase that he was, and she looked at a little 2-year-old toddling around, and she saw danger. And it scared the bejabbers out of her. Had no idea what this kid was capable of. And so Sarah goes to Abraham and puts out an ultimatum. The matter distressed Abraham greatly because it concerned his son. But God said to him, "Do not be so distressed about the boy and your maidservant," meaning Ishmael and Hagar. "Listen to whatever Sarah tells you, because it is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned." So God comes to him and says, the story is like, just like I said, it's going to play out. Isaac is going to be the guy. "I will make the son of the maidservant into a nation also, because he is your offspring as well." There's more to the story than what Abraham thought through Ishmael. Ishmael has a future, and he's happy about that. Hagar has a future, he's happy about that. Verse 14, the situation has come to a crisis. The group cannot live, coexist together anymore. Verse 14, early the next morning, Abraham took some food and a skin of water and gave them to Hagar. He set them on her shoulders and sent her off with the boy. She went on her way and wandered in the desert of Beersheba. Before, she went about halfway back to Egypt before she stopped at the well. This time, she gets about a fourth of the way there, what we call southwest Palestine, the desert of Beersheba. And now, the other dreams that she had, she's been here before, the loss of a husband. This time it looks final. The loss of security looks final. The loss of family and friends looks final. But all of those she'd experienced before, but there's something new that she goes through. And it seems to me that this may be the most painful of them all. And that is, she realizes that her 14 or 15-year-old son will probably never see his daddy again. She is truly now a single mom raising a teenage boy without the benefit or the example of his father. Now, I've talked to some moms who've been in this situation, similar to Hagar. And it seems to me that this is probably the most painful, even than those who have gone through a divorce, as painful as that is. That's where she is. Verse 15. "When the water in the skin was gone, she put the boy under one of the bushes to get some shade. Then she went off and sat down nearby about a bow shot away, for she thought, 'I cannot watch the boy die.'" Apparently he was dehydrating and losing strength and is curled up into some shade. She goes away. She just can't bring herself to sit with him. It just tears her apart so much. As she sat there nearby, she began to sob. Here again, she's at a place where she would say, "My life is over. Not just my life, but my boy. There's not a thing I can do about my boy." Now, through all of this, we have no record of her calling out to God in a personal way in all of this. No calling out to God, no prayer, No praise, no thanksgiving, no questions, nothing. Again, she's living on her longings and shattered dreams. Her longings and her shattered dreams, as if that's the storyline of her life. And it's the only storyline, apparently, she can see. But verse 17, like we saw earlier, God heard the boy crying out in the desert. And the angel of God called to Hagar. God hears and he speaks. Heard the boy crying, speaks to Hagar, said to her, "What is the matter, Hagar?" You say, what kind of question is that? It's the best question. Because the answer to the question is not, I need a solution to my problem. She does need water. She does need food. She does need sustenance. And so does her boy. But that's not her biggest problem. And this question is meant to be a question that asks her to think deeper about her life. What is the matter, Hagar? And then he gives a hint. Do not be afraid. Wait a minute. I don't have water. My son is dying. You're telling me not to be afraid? Yes. I have a deeper problem than my sustenance problem. Do not be afraid. God has heard the boy crying as he lies there. A solution is coming, but I'm not going to give a solution just out of the blue and let you continue to live a life of longings and shattered dreams, longings and shattered dreams, longings and shattered dreams, as if that's the storyline of your life. It's not. I am the storyline of your life. I am what you need most, and your son, what he needs most, is connection with me, which is what he's doing with her. Connection, relating, speaking to her. Do not be afraid. God has heard the boy crying as he lies there. God says, lift the boy up. Take him by the hand, for I will make him into a great nation. Still hasn't provided water, still hasn't provided sustenance, but what he is providing for her is hope. And she needs that more than even the water and the sustenance at this moment. Then God opened her eyes. Her eyes were closed, metaphorically. She saw a well of water, apparently that had been there the whole time. So she went and filled the skin with water and gave the boy a drink. God was with the boy as he grew up. He lived in the desert and became an archer. While he was living in the desert of Paran, his mother got a wife for him from Egypt. Now, God met her at two of her lowest points. And he reached out her to make a deep connection with her on both of those points. I'd like to be able to tell you that this story has a happy ending. But it doesn't. Because in spite of God meeting her at her deepest points and connecting with her and telling her and even touching that part of, I am the God who hears you, who hears your misery, who hears your boy crying. I'm the God who speaks to you. Do not fear. She continues to live her life on the basis of her longings and her shattered dreams. Her longings and her shattered dreams. Her longings and her shattered dreams. And I see it in three particular ways. Number one, we never have a record of her calling out to God. The second thing is that when she went the first time, she goes all the way halfway to Egypt on the road to Shur, desert of Shur. God meets her. She goes back. This time, she goes about a fourth of the way there to the desert of Beersheba, where God meets her this time. And then in the last verse, verse 21, it says, while he was living in the desert of Paran, that's about two-thirds of the way back to Egypt, maybe three-fourths of the way back to Egypt, almost all the way across the Sinai Peninsula. And then at the end, we said, his mother got a wife for him from Egypt. Her running away from God has led her all the way back to her dysfunctional past. The last thing that I hear when I think of this story and the unhappy ending of it, which goes on even till today, is that Isaac, the one who's born from Sarah, is going to have a grandson named Joseph. And he's going to be kind of a knucklehead, and his brothers are going to be very jealous of him. At some point, their jealousy is going to become raged. They're going to throw him down a well as if to leave him to die. And then a group of nomads come by on their camels, and they say, well, at least we can make some money out of this. They pull him out of the well, and they sell him to the group of nomads called the Ishmaelites. That's this boy's grandsons, Ishmael. She ran about halfway away from God the first time. God reached out to her, pulled her back. She flees from God a second time. God reaches out to her. She says, not enough. Let's pray together. Father, as I think about this story, I think about two things. I think about our innate stubbornness and our willfulness, that if we cannot have life on our terms the way we want it, we're just taking our football and going to go home. And we'll be mad at you and mad at the world. And we become a people cynical, critical, hardened. Who cares? I'll just do the best I can. Second thing I'm struck by is that even when everybody else gave up on her, and even she gave up on herself, you sure didn't. You chased her down even in the desert twice. And you revealed something of the wondrous personal nature in your heart for her. Even when she would have none of it in any part of the story, except in her utter desperation. And then only then, until life got a little better. That's not how we're to live. That's not what you have for us. That's not the storyline of life. The storyline of life is hooking our hopes and our dreams to your redemptive story and yielding ourselves as players in your drama. However you choose to use our lives, no matter how difficult, even when there are times we have to go back to our metaphorical submit to Sarah. Would you help us to see both ourselves today afresh and your heart for people, your heart for individuals, as you call us by name.
We at Pacific Church of Irvine invite you to join us every Sunday at 9:30. You can also visit our website at pacificchurch.com.